What's the only weekly wrap-up of the top compliance and ethics stories? It is This Week in FCPA with Tom Fox, the voice of compliance, and Jay Rosen, Mr. Monitor. Each week, Tom and Jay highlight 10 stories which caught their collective eye, talk about sports and movies, highlight top podcasts, and preview their upcoming events. Join This Week in FCPA each week for a one-stop review of the week's compliance and ethics highlights. This Week in FCPA is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
First, a word from our sponsor, Affiliated Monitors. Founded in 2004, Affiliated Monitors provides professional, independent integrity monitoring and ethics and compliance assessments nationally and internationally and across almost all industries. With its knowledge of effective ethics and compliance programs and cultures, Affiliated Monitor is respected for its work as the corporate monitor on matters ranging from multinational corporations to small and mid-sized companies and even individuals. Having served in over 750 monitorships, no one has more experience as an independent monitor than the team at Affiliated Monitors. For more information on how an independent monitor can help improve your company's ethics and compliance program, visit our sponsor, Affiliated Monitors, at www.affiliatedmonitors.com. In this first episode of 2020, we take a look at the James Bond-like flight of Carlos Ghosn to avoid prosecution in Japan. He was secreted out under the nose of Japanese officials who had on-site personal surveillance and electronic surveillance. He is now in Lebanon, which conveniently has no extradition treaty with Japan. We take a look at some of the top compliance failures from 2019 and some of the top compliance winners from 2019, both articles in Compliance Week. We ask, does compliance have a dark side? Jeff Kaplan explores this question. What about the combination of monitoring and compliance? Where does that intersect on your Venn diagram? Next, we look at the dangers of fraudulent access requests under the new CCPA, and we consider the differences in public company governance and JV governance. What is the story of corruption returning to South America? The SEC announces self-disclosure, cooperation, and remediation to combat accounting fraud, and 31 days to more effective compliance program. This Week in FCPA is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network. It's Tom Fox, the voice of compliance, back again with Mr. Monitors himself, Jay Rosen, for This Week in FCPA, episode 186, for the first week of the new year, ending today, January 3, 2020, the Ghosn the Ghost edition. As we ring in the first year of the new year and indeed new decade, we now have a new character in compliance and corporate governance. Although he's an old character, he's new to compliance, James Bond. And we're going to explore that at length. Jay wonders if the Patriots' run is at an end. And we had a lot of interesting compliance stories. So, Jay, you want to just jump right into it?
Sure. So I guess we'll do a little bit of Hollywood, a little bit of international intrigue. And as you said, we're going to look at Carlos's Ghosn's mysterious disappearance from Japan and reappearance in Lebanon. And we quote two different articles. One is from Ben Dooley on the New York Times, and one is from Nick Kostov at the Wall Street Journal. And this, we'll go with the Times first. Sitting in his rented home in a tiny Tokyo neighborhood one day in December, Carlos Ghosn walked John Lesher, a Hollywood producer, behind the Oscar-winning 2014 film Michael Keaton's Batman, through the plot of his own story, describing what he sees as his unjust imprisonment by Japanese officials and his struggle to prove his innocence, said people familiar with the discussions. The theme was redemption. The villain was the Japanese justice system. The talks were preliminary and did not get far, people said. But in any case, Mr. Ghosn was preparing to deliver a shocking twist. He was facing a trial later in 2020, filed by Japan, fled Japan for Lebanon this week, avoiding criminal charges of financial wrongdoing. All the elements of a Hollywood-style thriller were there. A private plane whisking a fugitive into the sky, multiple passports, rumors of shadowy forces at work, and people in power denying that they knew anything about this. It's not clear exactly why Mr. Goshen, when he began planning his escape, but his meeting with Mr. Lesher was one of several that he had during the last months in Tokyo as he contemplated the ending to the story of his flight from the Japanese justice system. His escape followed months of planning, as I said, and the former head of Renault-Nissan Alliance fled Japan to his homeland in Lebanon, where he believed he would get a much more friendly legal environment to try his claims of financial wrongdoing. The Lebanese government had for months been asking Tokyo to send Mr. Goshen, a Lebanese citizen, to Beirut, where it was proposed he would stand trial on corruption charges, according to a senior Lebanese official. Japanese authorities arrested Mr. Goshen in late 2018 and have accused the former automaker head of a series of financial crimes. It seems like everything came to the breaking point around Christmas time when not only was Mr. Goshen denied contact with his wife, but he was told that this trial may be broken up into multiple parts and might take several years. At this point, he decided to take his own safety and his own freedom into his hands, and using different folks, he was able to take a small chartered craft from Japan to Turkey to refuel and then get himself to Lebanon. So it's a fascinating story. We linked to both of the show notes, but Tom, what do you think from a legal perspective about the move, and what do you think that what options does it leave Mr. Goshen right now?
So before I get to that, Jay, I do have to ask on the record, are the rumors true that you've been approached to write this, turn this treatment into a screenplay?
I can't comment.
You can neither confirm nor deny?
Yes.
Well, the next series of questions really comes from, not from me, but from Conspiracy Tom. So Conspiracy Tom wants to know, was the Japanese government in on this? Did they realize that they had a problematic foreign national who was just going to cause a disruption, perhaps bring the Japanese government into disrepute in some manner, so that they did they facilitate this? Because you have to remember he was under 24/7 electronic surveillance, 24/7 video surveillance, 24/7 personal surveillance. So lots of questions from Conspiracy Tom about how this actually was allowed to occur. So it's great, though, to see James Bond making his appearance in the greater corporate governance and compliance world. The thought of Carlos Goshen standing trial in Lebanon for corruption is probably beyond laughable. He'll never stand trial for anything. I suspect he won't be holidaying in Asia Pacific region any longer. So I guess Tahiti is off, probably even Australia, although it may be burned out by the time he gets there. So the cedars of Lebanon are reputed to be some of the most beautiful trees in the world. So I hope he enjoys that mountain view. Lots of beach and coastline on Lebanon. So you know, lots of sand for Mr. Goshen to play in between his toes while he contemplates what could have been. So a great story. If I'd brought this to you, Jay, you would have looked at me and said, Tom, no one would ever believe this. Fiction has to be believable. So just going to show once again that in the greater world of anti-bribery, anti-corruption, it many times it is stranger than fiction.
And just when you thought you'd seen it all, you see something new. Next up, first of two articles from our friends at Compliance Week. Tom, what are the top compliance failures of 2019, according to our colleague Jacqueline Jaeger?
Well, Jacqueline had a great wrap-up of some of the failures. You're going to highlight some of the successes that Kyle Brasser wrote about. But some of the failures included tech, big tech, obviously Google, Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, continue to be in the news. I think Facebook has probably been the most at snubbing their nose at the public and saying, TS, baby, we're going to keep doing what we're doing. We don't care who it hurts. So it's going to be interesting to see how long they can have a viable business model with that attitude. The Justice's Antitrust Division is now looking more closely at Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon as well. Opioids and drug manufacturers, distributors had a very bad year, although they have to say they brought that on themselves. We had a $1.4 billion settlement from Reckitt Benckiser Group. Insys Therapeutics had a $225 million settlement. Novartis had a $700 million settlement. There's another $48 billion proposed settlement with Johnson & Johnson, Teva, and then distributors. So the opioid crisis comes to roost. KPMG had a very, very bad year, culminating in a $50 million settlement with the SEC over allegations that it not only stole confidential information belonging to the PCAOB in an effort to improve its annual inspection of KPMG audits, but that it cheated on internal exams from another enforcement action, and whether they the partners understood a variety of accounting principles. Not much giving you much comfort there. Telecom had a very bad year. MTS and Ericsson both had huge FCPA enforcement actions. And of course, our good friends, banks behaving badly, continue to behave badly. JP Morgan's compliance function really took a hit when it recommended cutting ties with Jeffrey Epstein, yet they were overruled by bank executives. A Swiss bank ignored recommendations. Its compliance officers put controls in place to help reduce U.S. clients evading taxes. The Deutsche Bank continued its imbroglio going forward. So banks behaving badly continues to be a theme, Jay. What about some of the compliance successes?
So as you said, the successes come to us from Kyle Brasser. Number one on his list, Apple. Apple set itself apart from its peers with a strong stance on data privacy. CEO Tim Apple, also known as Tim Cook, spoke in Brussels in October 2018, slamming those companies that put profits over privacy, and he doubled down on his pleas for the United States to adopt its own version of the European Union's GDPR. Walmart, in spite of tragedy that struck the supermarket chain in August when a gunman entered its store in El Paso, Texas, and shot 46 people, killing 22, the act of terror came just a couple days after two Walmart employees were killed by another employee at a store in South Haven, Mississippi. Walmart decisively responded by not only tightening its restrictions on firearm sales and banning civilians from carrying firearms into its stores, but it also vowed to share its compliance controls regarding the sale of firearms with other people and other companies. Walmart's stronger stance on gun control inspired others, such as fellow retailer Kroger, to also request customers not openly carry firearms in their stores. Starbucks, Target, and Wendy are among companies that had already had these controls in place. 2019 may well be the year of the whistleblower, although the record number of whistleblower cases did not top 2018, the unnamed whistleblower that sparked an impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump over allegations of corruptions has received the most attention. But there are also high profile accusations against General Electric, Walt Disney, and other large corporations. More importantly, Compliance Week commends the compliance officers that turn to whistleblowing when their advice to executives goes ignored. Unfortunately, these individuals aren't always celebrated, and in fact, in many cases, become the target for retaliation. Next up, we take a look at the Business Roundtable. They were received kudos for advancing the purpose of cooperation of what a modern business is supposed to do. And looking at its principles, in August, they issued a communication to all stakeholders, that including employees as opposed to just financial stakeholders, as previously noted by Milton Friedman. Each of the stakeholders is essential, the Business Roundtable wrote, and they commit to deliver value to all of them for the future successes of companies, communities, and countries. While this may be another case of we'll see it when we believe it, having the names of CEOs of companies like Amazon, American Express, Apple, Target, Walmart, and many others to sign on gives people hope. Finally, in the last group to get commended, the U.S. Women's National Team. Few would be quick to characterize the women's soccer team's fight for equal pay as one of compliance, but how this case plays out in the courts could affect the landscape for female employees everywhere. In fact, inspired by the 2019 World Cup champs, Senator Jackie Rosen, Democrat, Nevada, no relation, and Amy Klobuchar, Democrat, Minnesota, sent a letter in July to the chairman of the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, pressing for him to hold a committee hearing on the significant issue of pay disparity. So these five companies are serve as shining lights towards their stance on ethics and compliance and what happened last year. Next up, Tom, Jeff Kaplan considers his conflict of interest blog as, does compliance have a dark side?
So, yeah, Jay, this is an article that our good friend Jeff Kaplan wrote about a draft chapter in a book called The Dark Side of Compliance. It's to be published in the forthcoming Cambridge Handbook on Compliance by Professor J.S. Nelson at Villanova Law School. And she wrote that compliance systems can be abused. The fact that the positive image of compliance justifies establishment of tentacles throughout an organization, for example, enabling surveillance, invasive monitoring of the workplace. It allows management to push employees to cut corners, therefore creating conditions ripe for corporate wrongdoing. The author, Professor Nelson, also says that compliance mandates control and obedience to the rules, i.e. reminding us all of our parents, which, of course, we all will rebel against. I just made that last part up, but it's all true, that workers should not be sent messages that they should enhance profits. I have to just say that's about the most inane thing I've ever heard, because if you don't have profits, you're not going to have a company and you won't have a compliance function. But the Jeff really points out some of the errors in the analysis. But if people are really thinking this, Jay, and frankly, I don't know anyone else that is, it certainly presents challenges. In the United States, I think most employees expect to be evaluated in some form of a compliance manner, to have some form of compliance evaluation. The monitoring of employees is something that's done routinely through financial checks, oversight, internal controls, delegation of authority, and segregation of duties. And that's well known and well accepted. So the book is not out yet, and the chapter's not out yet. So perhaps there's some substance in there that we should think about or at least respond to. But I really have not heard of people bringing up kind of the dark side, and he whose name will not be mentioned, i.e. Lord Voldemort. I was never really thinking that he lived in compliance, but perhaps he does. Your thoughts?
Perhaps he does indeed. next up, Tom, I continue my series, wrapping up the year and wrapping up 15 years of independent monitoring excellence, where I spoke to the president and founder of Affiliated Monitors, my company, Vin DeCiani. And we decided to take a look at the combination of compliance and ethics programs with independent monitoring, as well as two DOJ memos that have been key in the selection and the application of independent monitors. According to Vin, the marriage of independent monitors and compliance and ethics programs has been facilitated through the evolution away from strict regulatory compliance to more ethics-based compliance. Early on, AMI had independent monitorships in the healthcare industry around issues such as billing and coding. From there, the focus of regulators expanded, and AMI began to address issues such as codes of conduct and conflicts of interest. In the late part of the past decade, AMI began to move into the Department of Defense independent monitorships around suspension and debarment. Suspension and debarment officials were very much focused on the ethics side of compliance and the oversight of companies going through suspension and debarment process. Administratively, the suspension and debarment officers would use suspension and debarment rules to have companies demonstrate that they met requirements under FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations. Ethics considerations included whether a company had installed a code of ethics, whether there was training on compliance and ethics programs, and whether there was a disciplinary process and investigative tools that included a hotline. DC Annie said that AMI was beginning to see different agencies picking up the elements of compliance and ethics programs. Next, he briefly discussed the first memo that affected the compliance industry, the Morford memo, which came out from the DOJ in 2008. And this memo, it codified many of the different issues of ethics and compliance monitors, selection criterion for independent monitors, and including the need for subject matter experts. Then we looked at the Benczkowski memo that came out 2 years ago, and this memo discusses limiting the use of monitors to only certain situations where they might be warranted, specifically where the company does not have an effective ethics and compliance program. So really, we've got one more episode, which will wrap into the new year on corporate compliance insights, and then we'll talk about his final reflections on 15 years of excellence in monitoring. And then at that point, we will move forward firmly in our 16th year. Next up, Tom, we've got danger of fraudulent access requests under the CCPA. What are the folks at Davis and Polk thinking?
So this comes to us from the New York University Compliance and Enforcement blog, and it's an interesting article about the requirement for companies in responding to customer data access requests. This is a well-known component of GDPR, and now here we are in January 3, the now-enforced California Consumer Privacy Act, CCPA. But the piece, blog post, points out that you have to authenticate who is making the request, and you need to have reasonable authentication procedures in place so that the information you dole out as a part of a customer access request, data access request, is actually legitimate. So the authors believe that U.S. companies may be facing a flood of access requests like those already inundating European businesses. And to comply with CCPA access requests, companies must develop a system agile enough to identify subject matter and respond to requests within the statutory time limits. So an interesting issue. I hadn't really thought about fraudulent access requests, but companies who might respond to a fraudulent access request by giving out confidential information certainly could find themselves under greater scrutiny.
So next up, we have a piece coming to us from the Harvard Law School Forum on Corporate Governance, and it's a real thoughtful piece on the differences between public companies and joint venture governance. And the governance of public companies is profoundly important. 30 years ago, CalPERS, a major institutional investor and leading corporate governance advocate, argued that the corporate governance was like the grain in the balance that makes the difference between wallowing for long and perhaps fatal periods in the depths of the performance cycle and responding quickly to correct the corporate course. Time and again, research had borne out the link between good governance and strong shareholder returns. Increasingly, public companies are entering into joint ventures to access new markets, combine capabilities, and gain scale. The largest oil and gas companies have used this tactic over the past several years, and joint ventures now make up 50% of the production coming. Meanwhile, large automakers and industrial firms, including General Motors, Siemens, and Volkswagen, derive substantial share of their revenue, profits, and risk exposure from joint ventures, especially in China. By almost every measure, the governance of these joint ventures is pound for pound more challenging than the governance of public companies. So what makes joint venture governance tougher? Water Street Partners has written extensively on the joint venture governance issue, including its challenges, links between good governance and performance, and on the contractual terms and practices that drive governance excellence. The aim of this note is to simply spell out why joint ventures governance is such a challenging issue compared to public company governance. there's an amazing 2.5-page chart where they take a look at the difference between public companies and JVs and what the three major key implications are include director training. JV board directors need training on how to perform their role, training which is anchored in the general principles of good governance and also reflects unique features of joint ventures. Director selection and expectation. When nominating executives to serve on JV boards, companies should have a clear-eyed view of which competencies and personal attributes a nominee will need to do the job well. They should further seek to nominate individuals who will realistically be able to dedicate time and thought to thoughtfully govern the venture and be able to remain on the venture board for a sufficient period of time. And the last one is contractual agreements and corporate governance policies. Lacking a global regulatory framework, JV legal departments and government policies need to do more work defining how the governance of the company will actually operate. More broadly, there are opportunities for companies in certain geographies, namely Europe, Saudi Arabia, China, and industries to work together to influence regulatory policy on the governance of joint ventures, such that regulatory framework is more clear with regard to unique issues that joint ventures introduce. Given the materiality and risk of joint ventures, isn't it time for companies to up their game on joint venture governance and stop pretending that governance is essentially the same as public company governance? The authors think so. So as I said, we will link to this in the show notes, and I heartily recommend that you review.
I'm not sure if this next article is sad or disturbing or both, but the New York Times, Ernesto Londoño and Leticia Casado reported that the pendulum has swung back and Latin America's corruption fight may have begun to stall. And obviously, if it's stalling, that means it could swing back the other way. Many of the politicians who were convicted of paying bribes or rather receiving bribes are now out of jail. They're seeking to regain their political status. They're making life extraordinarily difficult for whistleblowers and those who fought them. So we're going to have to see where this may go in Latin America. Obviously, the president of Brazil has come out pretty strongly against any additional anti-corruption prosecutions. So Brazil has really led the way. So it's going to be interesting to see if Brazil, they were recently criticized by the OECD for their lack or their turndown as well. So we're just going to have to watch this one going forward. There was an interesting OFAC/trade sanction case that Dylan Toker over at the Wall Street Journal Risk and Compliance Journal wrote about. You want to tell us about that, Jay?
Yeah, we don't usually see cases coming out this way. ExxonMobil Corp. Will not have to pay a fine for continuing to do business with a Russian state-run oil company amid increasing U.S. sanctions on the country, a federal judge ruled. U.S. District Judge Jane Boyle's ruling this week voids a $2 million fine that the U.S. Treasury Department had imposed on the Irving, Texas-based oil giant back in July of 2017 for allegedly violating U.S. sanctions when it entered into contracts with Russian oil firm PAO Rosneft. Exxon was fined for executing agreements with the state-run Rosneft after President Barack Obama issued sanctions against Russia for annexing Ukraine's Crimea region. Even though Rosneft wasn't added to the U.S. sanction list, the contracts were signed by the company's chief executive, Igor Session, who was. Exxon in 2018 said it was abandoning its venture with Rosneft after failing to secure a waiver from President Donald Trump. The lawsuit was seen by some sanctions lawyers as an opportunity to clarify an ambiguity about how OFAC enforces sanctions against blacklisted individuals. The agency has since released additional guidance on the issue, cautioning companies against entering into contracts signed by blacklisted individuals. In the lawsuit, Exxon pointed to a press release and public statements by the White House saying that the focus of the sanctions was on blacklisted individuals' personal assets rather than any companies they manage. Judge Boyle on Tuesday admonished Exxon for not seeking further guidance from OFAC, and the judge, however, said that OFAC ultimately failed to give the company fair notice of interpretation of the Ukraine sanctions, which was a violation of due process under the Fifth Amendment. So a bit of a pyrrhic victory for ExxonMobil, but some clarification nonetheless as to what OFAC and the judges are looking for. Tom, this week you had several different broadcasts that premiered on the Compliance Podcast Network. What would you like to direct our listeners to?
So, Jay, I'm extraordinarily pleased and excited to announce on this show that in the month of January, I'm running a daily podcast on 31 Days to a More Effective Compliance Program. The first 5 days are posted. Obviously, on the third day, it will be day three. But on day one, I took a look at what 2019 brought to compliance. On day two, the measurement of risk in a compliance program. Today, posting at noon Central Time, will be leadership's conduct at the top. Tomorrow on the fourth, we're going to take a look at moving tone down through an organization. In day five, we'll look at the board of directors and operationalizing compliance. This podcast series is one of my top podcast series I've done over the last several years. Huge numbers of people and huge fans of this. If you're the compliance practitioner, this is the podcast series for you. I give you about 5 to 7 minutes of things you can think about for your compliance program with three key takeaways that give you things you can do at little or no cost each day for your compliance program. At the end of 31 days, you'll have a great set of ideas that you can think about either implementing or enhancing your compliance program literally over the next year. So if you're a compliance practitioner, if you're listening to this podcast, check in on 31 Days to a More Effective Compliance Program. I've set it up as a separate iTunes channel, so I'm waiting on iTunes approval for that. And when that comes out, you'll be able to listen to these podcasts. I'm currently posting them on the FCPA Compliance Report, but they'll have their own iTunes channel so that you can listen to them straight through without having to search for them on my other channel. So it's a great series. It's a great boon for the compliance practitioner. I've had a ton of fun updating it. We had lots of compliance information come out last year in the form of the criminal sections, FCPA and compliance guidance, the antitrust sections guidance, and of course the OFAC compliance framework. I've incorporated all of those into this podcast series going forward, Jay.
Sounds like you've got it all. One question, you got Baby Yoda in there or not?
First of all, Jay, I must chastise you. It's not Baby Yoda. That is a misnomer. That's a colloquialism. It's the package. So,
or the kid.
Or the client. Or the kid.
Yep.
But not Baby Yoda. We have no official designation of a planet of Yodas even. So we're looking forward to Series 2 in the home world, although I would also alert watchers or listeners to this podcast, check out The Witcher. It's a great series on Netflix. Lots of blood and gore. I mean, lots of blood and gore. A little TNA if you're into that sort of thing.
With hunchbacks, right?
So, yeah, keep the children away if you have sensitive eyes and ears. Some really interesting series out. And, of course, the morning show on Apple TV. Sean Friedland and I are going to do some podcasts around that. He wrote a great piece that we linked to last week in our show notes. But, Jay, I guess, other than your now no comment about writing the screenplay for the Carlos Ghosn, the ghost story. How are you feeling about Saturday evening?
As you can see, when we set up our podcasts, we have a little name that you can put in the lower left-hand corner. And my name for this week's broadcast is TB12's Foxborough Finale. So I think the master is going to get bit by the student, Mike Vrabel, who many of you remember was a linebacker extraordinaire for the Patriots. And he had pretty good hands coming out of the backfield and had something like an 80% touchdown percentage. I think Vrabel has resurrected Ryan Tannehill's career. They're something like 7-3 since Tannehill's been the starter. I think the Titans continue on. I think it's Brady's last game in Foxborough, and rumors are he could be coming to the West Coast, and I might have to become a Los Angeles Chargers fan. But I think the Pats are washed up. When they play on wild card weekend, they are not as successful as when they have the bye. All six Super Bowls were won with the Patriots having a bye, and they would have a very long march to the Super Bowl. They'd have to go through both Kansas City and Baltimore. So I am less than optimistic. What do you say about your fellow Big Blue Michigan gunslinger?
So I think they're going to pull it out. One final win for TB12. So you want to take us home on that somber note?
Sure. That somber note. You know, sometimes you got to get realistic. It's a new year. It's 2020. We're looking with increased vision. On behalf of Tom Fox, the compliance evangelist and the voice of compliance, and myself, Jay Rosen, Mr. Monitor, we'd like to thank you for joining us for this week in FCPA, episode 186 for the week ending January 3rd, 2020. The Ghost and the Ghost. No, I am not writing the screenplay edition. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you in the coming week.
This is Tom Fox again. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of This Week in FCPA. If you have any questions, you can email Jay at jrosen at affiliatedmonitors.com. You can email me at tfox at tfoxlaw.com. I hope you'll join Jay and I again next week, where we take a look at some of the week's top stories and, of course, visit about the NFL playoffs. This Week in FCPA is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network and a proud member of C-Suite Radio. Thanks so much for listening, and we look forward to visiting with you again.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.